The first sign that something is amiss at Lee Harris's house is the plastic bottles.
Some bottles of water outside. Lots of them.
Dozens of clear 1 gallon bottles lined up outside the front door.
Nice shirt. I love Arcade Fire.
A fit blonde woman wearing an Arcade Fire t-shirt and a wide scarf holding her hair back comes out to greet me and my producer, Caitlin.
I'm Caitlin. Nice to meet you.
As you can see, we have a price to pay for living in paradise. You have to promise me to not think untoward of us because we've been literally camping in this house for 6 months now with no real running water.
Inside, more bottles on the kitchen counter and all over the tile floor, which Lee admits hasn't been cleaned in a while.
We do our best. We can't wash the floors or do things that normal water. You don't really think about how you use water on an everyday basis when it's just flowing from taps.
She could turn on the taps and clean water would come out, but at a price Lee can no longer afford. Because here in Rio Verde foothills, in the scrub outside Scottsdale, Arizona, Lee and her husband Frank are among hundreds of people scrambling for water after the city cut them off. It's June 2023, and for more than 6 months at this point, Lee and Frank have been doing everything they can to avoid turning on their taps.
And I literally took a pack of rubber bands, I mean really strong ones, and I banded all of the handles. You need to break yourself of that muscle memory of turning on and off a faucet.
To get by, they've been living on water borrowed from work or friends' houses and collecting rainwater to flush their toilets and water their plants. But out here, during one of the hottest and driest summers on record, there hasn't been much rain, nearly none at all. And they're doing whatever they can to save every last drop that they have.
I'm standing in my master bathroom shower. I've got several buckets of rainwater. It takes about 2 gallons to flush a toilet, and we go ahead and put it into the tank behind the toilet. So here you go. Anything to stay in our house, right? You've got to do what you got to do.
I'm Amy Scott, and this is the Marketplace special, How We Survive, The Worth of Water. More than 20 years into a mega drought made worse by climate change, a lot of scientists think the word drought doesn't really cut it anymore. That what we're looking at in the American Southwest is aridification, a long-term drying out of the region. The go-to source of water, the Colorado River, can no longer accommodate everyone. And some of the fastest-growing cities in the country, Denver, Phoenix, Las Vegas, depend on a dwindling resource. Scientists tell us by 2050, more than 5 billion people around the world will face water shortages. So over the next hour, we will explore solutions, from the technology that's creating drinking water from some surprising sources to a growing movement to rethink our relationship with nature. We're going to start with the story of Lee Harris and Frank Avril and how they adapted to a crisis that could be in store for more of us in the future. It all started about 5 years ago when Lee and Frank started looking for a house near Scottsdale and discovered Rio Verde Foothills, an unincorporated community in Maricopa County.
Frank and I are big outdoors people. We love hiking. And we'd be looking down over this very large expanse of desert, and we'd see houses kind of placed in and around this gorgeous Sonoran desert type of landscape. And we go, you know, that's a really pretty area.
They found what seemed like the perfect place, a large stucco house with high ceilings and 35 windows to take in the mountain views. Plus, it had this other special quality.
Its acoustics are superb.
Frank, an accomplished classical oboist, fell in love, and I'm not kidding here, with the walls.
Because the walls are circular, It's resonant, but without being bouncy. Anytime, day or night, I can practice the oboe.
You had a very specific wish list for a house.
Absolutely.
There was just one catch.
Yeah, it's a beautiful home, but it is completely, you know, dependent on hauled water.
Like many houses in rural communities, this one didn't come with a built-in supply of water, no pipes connected to a city water utility, but also no well to draw from. Instead, it had a 5,000-gallon underground water tank, which they'd have to pay someone in a huge truck to come and fill. Scottsdale is the nearest city. Guys in big trucks would buy water from the city and bring it out to Lee. It made her pause.
It brought to mind the fact that we are on our own little island in this house, and it is a beautiful little, you know, island of paradise, but we have finite resources, and that tank was our finite resource.
Still, for its size and beauty, the house was affordable, by Scottsdale standards, about $500,000. It would be a stretch. Franck's mom has Alzheimer's disease, and he pays for her expensive care.
You know, he blew most of his retirement just being able to get her into a care that would allow her to be, you know, clean and happy and taken care of by nurses.
Lee and Franck are both semi-retired. She works at an assisted living facility, Franck at a grocery store. But between the sale of a condo they owned and their income from Social Security and their hourly jobs, they decided they could make it work. Then, 6 months after moving in, Lee was out driving when she noticed something.
I started seeing signs on the Rural Metro Fire Department property that said, "Got water?"
She was intrigued. What could that be about?
I immediately thought, this is not a good sign. I mean, the banner was a good banner, but this is not a good sign for us as a community if there is a question about water supply.
When she got home, Lee pulled up the website she'd seen on the banner, and she would learn something disturbing. Years earlier, the city of Scottsdale had warned the two main water hauling companies in the community that it might have to cut off water to Rio Verde foothills. If the drought got severe enough, Scottsdale announced that it would prioritize its own residents.
They tried to let us know that there was an oncoming train way in the distance, but that it would arrive if that drought continued.
As that train approached, the community was divided over what to do. Some residents wanted to form a quasi-government entity to buy water from somewhere else. Others, who had wells, worried that such an entity could threaten their private property rights. They couldn't work anything out. Lake Mead, the reservoir that supplies Colorado River to people across the West, dropped to an all-time low. And on January 1st, 2023, Scottsdale officially turned off the water to Rio Verde foothills.
The city of Scottsdale stopped the transportation of water, making good on a year's worth of warnings that the municipal water supply was running dry.
Tonight, a community desperately searching for a source of water.
Water tanks and reservoirs here at homes in the Rio Verde foothills community are running low with no guarantee that they're going to be refilled.
Lee and Franck, along with anyone living on hauled water, would have to buy it somewhere else. The price jumped from about $130 for a full tank to more than $500.
Because of not the water, but the diesel, the cost of diesel to truck in that water from more distant points.
At that rate, Lee and Franck would have to pay about $380 a month. They couldn't afford it. For context, the average water bill for a single-family house in Scottsdale is $84. So Lee and Franck started to do everything they could to conserve. Lee showered at a gym near work. They ate a lot of packaged food, things that don't use water.
We use whatever you can stick in a microwave and not add anything to.
And they invested in huge tanks to collect rainwater coming off their roof whenever it actually rained in the desert.
I mean, some people might hear this and say, well, why don't they leave? I mean, if you were to try to sell this house, would you be able to?
No. I mean, we could probably sell it for maybe a quarter of what it's worth. But for my husband and I, this is our nest egg. This is everything we have. And if we had to sell it at a rock bottom price, we'd lose everything that we had worked for most of our lives as professionals.
Lee and Frank lived this way for months, through a summer heat wave that just wouldn't let up. Phoenix reported record heat and record drought. The usual monsoon rains didn't come. Things started looking pretty dire.
Okay, it is July 2nd, and it's 108 degrees outside, and the sun just went down, so Frank and I are going ahead and filling up the buckets now that it's getting cooler.
These are voice memos they sent me to let me know how they were doing. Each week, Frank, who's 70, transports 12, 13, 14 buckets full of water from the dwindling rainwater tank to the house. Lee fills plastic bottles at work or friends' houses to use at home.
I'm going to fill up some empty 28-ounce bottles of Gatorade that we already consumed, but now we can use to fill with just tap water so that we can wash our faces and hands and brush our teeth at home.
It's like their whole life revolves around finding and transporting water from outside of their home.
It's been a bummer to try to figure out, okay, how long can I stay human in living in this type of situation where I can't wash myself in my own home? I'm just getting tired of trying to figure out ways in order to save a couple of ounces of hot water here, or, you know, the potable water from the city there.
But finally, a solution was in sight. That same summer, the Arizona legislature approved a bill allowing Rio Verde Foothills to create what's called a standpipe district that would buy water from a private company and use Scottsdale's infrastructure to deliver it to Rio Verde Foothills.
Oh my gosh, here it comes.
And in late October, Lee sent me another voice memo.
And the truck is just about to turn onto our property, coming down the driveway. This is massively exciting. honey, water delivery truck's here. Oh, here it comes.
About 9 months after Scottsdale shut them off, the residents of Rio Verde Foothills were finally able to access their new supply of water.
That's the sound of that glorious water going into our underground tank that will allow our house to become functional again.
This doesn't mean a complete return to normal. Lee and Frank are still paying more than twice what they used to for water, and the deal is temporary. Long term, the community will have to help pay for a new standpipe and processing plant. Lee says what happened in her community could be a cautionary tale for other rural places.
So when I tell people I'm going to Rio Verde Foothills, people in Arizona, water policy, they say, oh, but that's just such an outlier. That's just a few hundred homes. What's your response to that?
What happened to us being the one community that was left without the chair in the game of musical chairs can happen to just about any rural community if they don't have that water source secured. And I mean not just water credits or this that looks like water is guaranteed. I'm talking about wet water.
Knowing what you know now, looking back, if you're really honest with yourselves, was it a mistake?
No. I mean, that's my answer right away.
Yeah. I look outside and I see the beauty of this place. We love the Rio Verde Foothills.
Lee says the whole ordeal has made them more prepared, physically and emotionally, for the reality of our climate-challenged future.
These days, the lesson has been learned.
You don't waste a drop of water. Not now.
When I last heard from Lee, she let me know they've now installed a rainwater purification system so they can drink and cook with any rainwater they collect. That's an individual solution, but we're going to need solutions on a much bigger scale. We'll look at some of them after the break.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Amy Scott, and this is the Marketplace special, How We Survive, The Worth of Water. Water supplies in many parts of the West are drying up for all sorts of reasons: overuse, drought, climate change. The good news is that water is all around us, if you know where to look and how to treat it. Technology is helping create clean drinking water from the ocean, the sewer, and even out of thin air. So last summer, I took a water-tasting road trip to check out some of the innovations that could help us adapt to a drier future.
It's time for trivia!
It's trivia night at Desert Monks Brewing in Gilbert, Arizona, outside Phoenix.
Whoever wins first game wins a $10 gift certificate! Yay!
The crowd is lively, and the beer is flowing.
Oh yeah, the rules. Don't internet cheat. And while you're discussing the answers, keep your voice within your team.
Trivia nights are popular here, but lately Desert Monks has been getting lots of attention for its beer, one in particular.
This is our Town Square Lager.
That's Summer Decker, one of the brewery's owners.
Prost. Town Square Lager. It's really refreshing. As lagers are intended to be. Oh, I really needed a beer. I didn't realize it.
This was a special batch because of the type of water Desert Monks used to brew it. Summer describes it as the purest kind of water, like a blank canvas. But the water didn't start out that way.
The water that we get from the city of Scottsdale, this direct potable reuse water, is so clean and fresh.
Wow. And this is wastewater, right? This is coming from the sewer?
Originally, yes.
That's right. Town Square Lager was brewed with recycled wastewater from the nearby city of Scottsdale. About 70% of the city's water comes from the Colorado River. But with recent cuts to its share of the river, and more likely coming, Scottsdale needs alternatives.
I think it's just that next step that we need to take in the Southwest to provide a sustainable water solution for us.
This is Brian Biesmeyer, the executive director of Scottsdale Water, the city's water utility. The next step Brian is talking about is turning wastewater into safe drinking water. Brian prefers another term, ultra-pure water.
We live in a desert environment. We all know we don't get much rain. Our water resources are limited. And this is a way to maximize the water resources we do have. And recycling water and making this ultra-pure water available for drinking water purposes seems just that next step that we need to do as water managers for the region.
So can we see how it works?
Yes, please.
Brian takes us to a viewing area at Scottsdale's Advanced Water Treatment Plant, where we see clusters of long tubes.
This is our first membrane treatment.
Before it even gets here, the wastewater has gone through treatment to remove solids and other gunk.
We actually use microbes, naturally existing microbes, to degrade waste and to eat that waste up.
Then the clear water goes through several more rounds of treatments and filtration to remove bacteria, viruses, and other particles. Then it's disinfected with ultraviolet light. Once they're sure it's clean, a few minerals are added in for taste.
Because there's nothing in the water, and most people enjoy water that actually has some minerals in it. Many bottled water manufacturers do the same thing.
Scottsdale Water isn't sending any of this water directly to taps yet, but for decades it's been pumping the stuff into the ground, where it trickles through hundreds of feet of soil, a natural filter, and into the aquifer, and eventually gets pumped back out and treated again before going to residents. That's known as indirect potable reuse, and lots of communities do it. But with the ongoing drought, Scottsdale is moving toward direct potable reuse, skipping the aquifer and sending the water right into its drinking water supply. And that means some PR to convince customers that it's safe. Did you have any sort of ick factor when you first started thinking about this?
No, I have no. I have no qualms about it. We understand why folks could have some qualms about it. But I think when they look into the science, they look at the quality of the water we actually produce, they see the test of the water that we produce, a reasonable person will be won over.
To win people over, Scottsdale Water is teaming up with one of the country's most beloved beverages, beer. The agency launched a campaign to get local breweries, like the one I visited earlier, to use recycled wastewater in their beer. There's even an annual showcase for brewers using recycled water called One Water. Desert Monks has been so happy with the result, they plan to start brewing most of their lagers from recycled Scottsdale water. Okay, so we already know I was a fan of the beer.
Wow. Okay, it's a drinking fountain.
Yeah, we wanted this to look like something people are familiar with.
But what about the recycled water all by itself?
All right, should I go for it? I'm going to drink out of this drinking fountain. It looks like the kind you'd find in an airport, only it's ultra-pure recycled water. It tastes like bottled water, just like you said it would.
Like
I was thirsty.
Yeah, drink as much as you want.
It is hot, yeah.
I can tell you that generally people like the taste of our recycled water. Why? Because it's the same process bottled water use.
I have to tell you, my 12-year-old daughter, when I told her I was coming here and that I was going to taste some recycled wastewater, she said, well, isn't all water recycled wastewater? I was
smart
like, damn,
girl.
Kid.
Smart girl. So yes, in the natural environment's been done since the earth came into being. So all we do here is we take that natural environment and we accelerate it with a technology.
Water experts say this is the future, and attitudes are changing slowly. From Los Angeles to Wichita Falls, Texas, cities across the Southwest, big and small, are working on plans for direct potable reuse. In Scottsdale, the goal is to start sending its clean, recycled water directly to customers by 2026. That's a lot of time to get used to the idea. The next stop on our water tasting tour is not far away, on a rooftop in Scottsdale.
We're going up onto the roof. Thank you. Oh yeah, it is bright.
We're surrounded by beautiful desert hills shimmering in the heat.
Ooh, I'm totally gonna get vertigo.
We came to the roof, not for the view, but for a glimpse at a mind-blowing piece of technology.
So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so 10 of these up here.
It's an installation of what look like solar panels, but do something very different. These are called hydro panels, and they're pulling water straight out of the dry desert sky. Sounds a bit like something you might have seen in a movie.
What I really need is a droid who understands the binary language of moisture evaporators.
Evaporators?
If you've ever watched Star Wars, you may remember Luke Skywalker grows up on a desert planet. His family makes a living as moisture farmers, using devices that pull drinking water from the air. And the vaporator devices in Star Wars are a bit like the tech behind these hydro panels. Cody Friesen is the founder and CEO of Source, the company that makes them.
Think about the way that if you leave the lid off of a sugar bowl, over time it gets a little bit clumpy because obviously the sugar is absorbing water vapor from the air. The sciencey word is that the sugar is hygroscopic.
Okay, this next part gets a little technical, but stay with me. We're going to get into how the panels work. So you've got the sugar in the bowl getting clumpy.
Now imagine that we have a material that's engineered to do that same process very rapidly. We then show those materials to sunlight, which causes the water vapor to respire.
Meaning the water vapor is evaporated and condensed to create liquid water.
And you do that many, many times per day. And so very efficiently now we can produce drinking water really anywhere.
Even in bone dry Arizona.
Water vapor is actually everywhere on the planet. And even when it's hot and dry out, hot air holds a lot more water vapor than cold air. And so even though the relative humidity is low, the absolute humidity may not be. And so in a place like Arizona in the middle of summer, when it's literally sub 5% relative humidity, there's still a lot of water vapor in the air.
How much water can one of those panels produce here on a hot day?
Yeah, so each panel can do about 5 liters a day, so like 10 standard 16-ounce bottles of water a day. And so, you know, if you had two on your home, you'd be producing like a case of bottled water a day. So two panels enough for the drinking and cooking water for a family.
So not enough to run a dishwasher or shower in, but enough to survive on. And in places where clean drinking water is scarce, like the Navajo Nation, that could be a lifeline.
Because as soon as you have a hydro panel at your home, you own intrinsically your own drinking water supply.
About a third of the households on the Navajo Nation have no running water. A partnership has installed more than 500 Source panels on the reservation, with plans for hundreds more. But you may be wondering, like I did, how does it taste?
All right, let's go try some.
All right.
In the kitchen at Source headquarters, near the Pac-Man arcade machine, there's a water dispenser fed by the hydro panels on the roof. My producer, Caitlin, and I check it out.
Tastes like water. Caitlin, you should try some.
The thing about water, it's like you really only notice it if it's like not good. It's not good.
I love it.
The highest compliment. Okay, and I am going to fill up my water bottle if you don't mind.
No, please.
For our final stop in our water tasting tour, we're leaving the desert and heading west to the beach. Ah, that's the sound of the Pacific Ocean. After Arizona, I kept heading west and reached Carlsbad, California. It's peak summer. Locals and tourists are surfing, swimming, soaking in the sun. There's a guy sitting in a van with his laptop open, hair still wet after surfing. And just across the street from the beach, a chain-link fence and what looks like a big industrial park. You can't really tell what it is. An old power plant, maybe?
Hi.
Hi.
Our parking lot's full here, but there's some...
We're at the Claude Bud Lewis Carlsbad Desalination Plant, where water from the Pacific Ocean is being turned into drinking water. About 54 million gallons a day, making up about 10% of the local water supply.
So we're a piece of the pie, as I like to say, in San Diego region's water portfolio, making sure that it's diverse and continue to provide reliable, high-quality water.
That's Michelle Peters. She runs operations here and will be our tour guide.
Okay. So actually, real quick before we do go out, a couple safety things. So everyone has hard hat vest glasses. No pressing any big red buttons. I know it's tempting, but they do work.
Are there big red buttons?
There are big red buttons.
I'm gonna have to keep my hands in my pocket.
The first thing you need to know about seawater desalination is that the technology has been around for centuries. There are 17,000 operational desal plants around the globe using various techniques. The Carlsbad plant uses reverse osmosis. Every day, 100 million gallons of seawater come in from the ocean through this 72-inch pipe.
In big green letters, seawater supply.
Yes.
Pointing up.
And go through various treatment stages. The saltier seawater or brine that's left over is then diluted and sent back to the ocean. The entire process, from the moment it comes into the plant, takes about an hour and a half, almost as long as our visit. Plans to build this plant started in the 1990s, when San Diego County was in a brutal drought, importing almost all of its water from the Colorado River and Northern California. It wasn't completed until 2015.
Now we're 20-plus years into another mega drought. Has this solved San Diego's water problems?
To say it's solved is maybe a bit of a stretch, I think, but it has played a very key and critical role.
It's a controversial solution. Desalination is expensive. The Carlsbad plant cost $1 billion. Critics worry that all that super salty water or brine that's being released back into the sea could wreak havoc on marine ecosystems. And removing salt from ocean water sucks up a lot of energy. But desal isn't going away. California regulators have approved a new plant in Orange County. Arizona's considering a plan to import desalinated water from Mexico.
So we're going to just walk back through the plant here.
And now it's time for a taste.
Try the water and tell us how we did.
All right, this is for me. I am kind of thirsty. So Michelle has opened the tap and is filling up a bunch of glasses of water for us. Plastic cups, really.
Yeah.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Ocean water.
Tastes like water?
Tastes like water.
It's good.
It tastes like bottled water. So tell me what to be looking for. Help me develop my palate for water.
The lightness on the tongue, perhaps.
It's got a nice mouthfeel.
Yeah. It does have a good mouthfeel. Yeah, exactly. You're a pro already.
What about the nose?
But yeah, on the nose, we hope you don't smell anything. Yeah. That's like you shouldn't.
One thing water experts seem to agree on, there isn't a single solution, no panacea that will get us out of the water crisis. We're going to need all the solutions we learned about today and countless other innovations that are getting the attention of investors. An estimated $1.2 billion of venture capital funding has gone into water technology over the past 2 years. Still just a fraction of the $70 billion pouring into climate tech overall. So we're going to need way more investment. And we may have to reconsider how we think about the natural sources of water we have.
In my opinion, this creek is alive. You can hear it. You can see it moving. You can taste it. You can smell it. And so in our opinion, it is alive and it has a right to exist.
That's after the break. We'll be right back. I'm Amy Scott, and this is the Marketplace special, How We Survive, The Worth of Water. Back in 2017, New Zealand's parliament took a historic vote.
We've heard this bill today called revolutionary, unique, and I want to call it extraordinary.
Lawmakers voted to give the Whanganui River, the third longest river in the country, a special status.
Here today, we recognize a river and its catchment as a legal entity, a legal person.
That's right, a legal person. It's part of a growing movement rooted in indigenous values to give nature, rivers, fish, crops, and trees, the same rights as people. Maori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, had been fighting for the rights of the Whanganui since the 1800s, when British colonizers began settling along the river and exploiting and polluting it for industry. Personhood would give the river the same rights as people in New Zealand and allow guardians to speak on its behalf. The day Parliament passed the law, a group of Maori people were sitting in the chamber, along with lawmakers, and sang a folk song called a waiata in celebration.
It was a change moment, a whole catalyst change moment for all of us in New Zealand. I'm incredibly proud of it.
That's Maori law professor Jacinta Ruru at the University of Otago. She says, in practice, personhood means the river, through its guardians, can now take polluters or developers to court to enforce its rights. But she says it's the beginning of a much longer process.
It will take generations to unravel, undo all of that colonial damage, destruction, because we have to work towards resetting our relationships, our human relationships with this river.
Resetting our relationships. I wondered, could that happen for another distressed river on the other side of the world? To find out how rights of nature might work for the Colorado River, I wanted to talk to the guy who actually tried it. So before we dive in, I want to ask about your email signature, which as a Gen Xer, I love, from Jeff Spicoli. Tell me about that.
Yeah, sure. I think Fast Times at Ridgemont High is not just a cult classic, but is a classic as a commentary on the United States.
Jason Flores Williams is a lawyer who works on environmental and civil rights cases, and his email signature says a lot about his style. It's a quote from Sean Penn's character in the 1982 movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
He references summarizing the American Revolution, the Thomas Jefferson quote, where he says,
what Jefferson was saying was, hey, we left this England place because it was bogus. So if we don't get some cool rules ourselves, pronto, we'll just be bogus too. Yeah?
And I just think it's the perfect way. I just summarized it the most essentially perfect way. The reason why the United States has a constitution and our own set of laws in contrast to England from which we divided.
Because we didn't want to be bogus.
Yeah, you'll be bogus too, man.
But Jason says the cool rules the U.S. government came up with haven't worked out so well for the environment. So in 2017, he filed a lawsuit against the state of Colorado on behalf of the Colorado River. I asked him to read a statement he made about the case at the time.
We're bringing this lawsuit to even the odds. Corporations today claim rights and powers that routinely overwhelm the efforts of people to protect the environment. Our judicial system recognizes corporations as persons, so why shouldn't it recognize the natural systems upon which we all depend as having rights as well?
The lawsuit asked a federal court to recognize the right of the Colorado River to, quote, exist, flourish, regenerate, be restored, and naturally evolve. Jason was inspired by what happened in New Zealand and shortly after in India, which granted two rivers living human status. Because the Colorado River couldn't appear in court, Jason needed to find some plaintiffs to stand in for the river. But it wasn't easy. Rights of nature is still a pretty radical idea in the United States. So he finally recruited a controversial environmental group called Deep Green Resistance. The lawsuit made a splash. Lots of news outlets covered it. There was excitement for a split second.
And then invariably what happened, and I should have just expected this, was the Attorney General of Colorado at the time sought severe sanctions against me for signing this lawsuit seeking personhood for the river. Everything from serious monetary sanctions to disbarment.
The Attorney General's office cited multiple issues with the lawsuit, claiming it was unconstitutional and that the plaintiffs didn't have standing, basically that they hadn't shown they had a legitimate injury, and said if Jason didn't voluntarily drop the lawsuit, the plaintiffs could face penalties too.
So I have an ethical duty to go back and tell people involved that, hey, this could be these sanctions could extend to you. And then everything just broke apart.
Jason requested a dismissal of the suit. And just like that, it was over. Were you willing to risk disbarment yourself? I mean, is it really that the plaintiffs backed out, or were you also a little bit worried about the consequences for yourself?
Hell yeah, I was worried. I mean, I don't want to be disbarred. And ultimately, and this is ultimately my responsibility, and I completely accept that, is that it's just very difficult to make a stand.
Rights of nature is a contentious idea, to say the least. In the U.S. legal system, property rights and individual freedom reign. And giving nature the same rights as people and corporations challenges these deep-seated values.
And there's a lot of fear, and fear is just a part of the experience in fighting for something new, the unknown.
6 years later, there are still some in Colorado who are fighting on behalf of rivers and trying a very different approach.
In my opinion, this creek is alive. You can hear it. You can see it moving.
Gary Wachner is director of Save the Colorado, a nonprofit that works to protect and restore the Colorado River and its tributaries. And for the past few years, he's been advocating for the rights of waterways throughout the state of Colorado.
You can taste it, you can smell it, and it has a right to exist.
I met Gary in the small mountain town of Nederland, where Boulder Creek flows through town. A few years ago, he helped Nederland pass a resolution recognizing the rights of the creek and its watershed after a mine upstream was accused of polluting the creek with heavy metals.
It was a bit of a rallying cry for the community to help speak for the creek so that it would have the right to flow and not be polluted.
Since then, he's helped pass resolutions for waterways in Grand Lake, Ridgeway, and recently Lyons, Colorado. They're not legally binding, but more of a statement of values.
It would guide how the town would address issues that come before it, like development plans, pollution plans, anything like that, or plans to divert new or large amounts of water.
Gary is trying to avoid what's happened with other rights of nature efforts, like with Jason Flores Williams in Colorado. A few years ago in Florida, the state legislature preempted a successful county ballot measure by banning local governments from passing rights of nature ordinances.
What we're trying to do is, slowly but surely, in a friendly way, to bring that concept into the hearts and minds of the people of the state of Colorado and the Southwest United States, and then eventually into the legal system.
Yeah, those resolutions are pretty pointless, in our opinion, just to be blunt.
Thomas Lindsay is senior legal counsel for the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights, a nonprofit organization based in Washington State.
You don't change the system of law by passing a non-binding resolution that says, wouldn't it be great if we changed the system of law? You actually write a new law that then gets adopted, which challenges those other layers of law. That's how it works.
Lest you think he's just cynical, Thomas is the go-to rights of nature guy. He helped write the very first rights of nature law in the world in Tamaqua Borough, Pennsylvania, in 2006. He then went on to help Ecuador craft rights of nature language into its constitution and has been involved with dozens of municipal and tribal rights of nature laws in this country. Thomas agrees that hearts and minds need to be changed.
We have this Western European concept of nature as a thing, something to be used, like with the Colorado River, for example, the seven states fighting over how much water we're going to get from it, without allowing the Colorado River to actually be in the room to say, this is what I need.
Thomas says many of these efforts have been led by indigenous communities, as in New Zealand, that have a different relationship with nature. Last year, Jack Fyander, a lawyer and member of the Yakima Nation, fought for the rights of nature on behalf of another tribe.
I was made an honorary member of the Soxhlwaddle tribe and given the name in their language of Duktukwiatkan, which unfortunately for me translates into protector of all that is sacred, which put a heck of an obligation on me to live up to that.
The Soxhlwaddle tribe filed a lawsuit in tribal court against the city of Seattle. The tribe argued that salmon, which are sacred to the Soxhlwaddle, have a right to exist and that the hydroelectric dams on the Skagit River were harming the fish by damaging their habitat and blocking their passage upstream, and in turn, harming the tribe.
Tribal members rely on salmon for their food. Sometimes they sell some to buy gas from their cars for their economy. But also it's a cultural thing because the tribe has a treaty which guaranteed them the right to fish.
Last year, Seattle settled and agreed to create passages in the river for the salmon, though it didn't acknowledge the salmon's rights. Jack says the city hasn't begun building the passages, so he's not celebrating just yet.
Still cautious. Tribal nations are very experienced in having promises made to them which were not kept.
Jack says he thinks the city settled because the licenses for the dams were up for renewal at the same time the tribe's lawsuit was getting a lot of press and Seattle's reputation was on the line. But Jack is pragmatic. He says the motivation isn't what really matters.
I think the way to convince people that you should support the rights of salmon is to appeal and to and present it to their Western views. Not that you're recognizing the salmon's rights, but you're recognizing the salmon rights because that protects your rights. You protect nature, then you'll be able to exploit it for over a longer period of time.
Oof, it's pretty depressing. But Jack has been fighting this fight for a long time. I'm wondering if you were trying to protect the Colorado River, you know, which serves 7 states, 2 countries, and 30 tribal nations, provides water to 40 million people. How would you approach that? Do you think it could work for a whole river basin?
Well, oftentimes I'm inclined to take off my attorney hat and just speak as a tribal elder, because in that capacity, I'm entitled to kind of scold people. Water law in this country is based on taking the water out of the ground or out of the river for your own use. That's how you get a water right, by taking it away from nature and using it yourself. And it's sort of like rewards that someone who uses water, because the earlier you use it and the more you take, the greater your right is.
It's known as the doctrine of prior appropriation. It's a bit like finders keepers.
And that's just wrong. To use more water than they need, because if you don't use it, someone else gets to use it, and it treats the water like property.
But Jack says attitudes are changing. When he talks to groups about the idea that nature has inherent rights that need protection,
the adults tend to look at you like this is an idea that came to you at midnight when you had tinfoil on your head, you know, from from outer space. It's too new. But what gives me hope is that the young people and the students, unlike the older people, they get it, you know, because harms to nature is something that's going to affect them deeply in their future. And they see it with the climate change. So I guess it's the young people that give me hope, because they really get it.
If the Colorado River did have rights, what would it say? And who would speak on the river's behalf? I think about all of this when, at the end of the summer, my husband Alex and I go for a hike we've been wanting to do for a long time to the headwaters of the Colorado River. We're in Rocky Mountain National Park, and as soon as we set out from the Colorado River trailhead, nature asserts itself.
All right, well, our first obstacle is a herd of elk blocking our trail. You know, they can be aggressive, so can we just be like, excuse us, pardon me?
There's a whole living, breathing ecosystem around this river, including this herd of mama elk with their babies.
We're totally surrounded by them now.
What do we do if they charge? Curl up in a ball?
They don't charge. And 7 miles later, finally exhausted, we reach a wet, grassy meadow.
I guess this is it right here.
We're about 10,000 feet above sea level, surrounded by rocky peaks and a bluebird sky.
Wow. Here it is. We finally reached the headwaters of the Colorado River. How cool.
It's kind of an emotional experience being up here. I was born and raised in Colorado. I grew up drinking this water without even really thinking about where it came from. We have messed with this river so much. I can't help but feel bad for it. Even up here, a lot of the water that would flow into the Colorado is diverted by a ditch built in the 1890s to supply farms and cities to the east.
And it's sad to think about how much strife this river has caused downstream. It's not the river's fault, it's the people's fault.
And now it's our job, as much as we can, to fix it. I'm your host, Amy Scott. The rest of the team is Caitlin Esch, Haley Hirschman, Marissa Cabrera, Lena Fonsa, Courtney Bergseeker, and Sophia Polisa Carr. We had help from Peter Balanon-Rosen and Marketplace reporter Savannah Marr. Our editors are John Gordon and Jasmine Romero. Sound design by Chris Julin and engineering by Brian Allison. If you want to hear more stories about climate change solutions, check out How We Survive wherever you listen to podcasts. This has been How We Survive, The Worth of Water, from American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work? I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.